This is 91.5 KUNV, and you're listening to Neon Eden. I'm J. Patrick Cooligan, columnist for the Las Vegas Sun and Las Vegas Weekly. My guest today, Dave DeMoor, professor of political science here at UNLV. He is a doctorate from UC Davis and has been here since fall of 2000. We thank you for being here, Dave.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start and talk about as we gear into election season here. I think there's been some interesting political science that's kind of gotten into the popular press that has really contradicted the typical campaign narrative you see in journalism. And of course, that's filled with polls and ads and messages. And what the political scientists have said, the last couple cycles especially, is that what you really need to be paying attention to are economic conditions. So talk about that a little.
This is it's an ongoing fight in our discipline as well, because you have this sort of two schools of thought, that the campaigns don't matter thought, and you can do a pretty good job of predicting election winner losers by looking at things like, say, the economy 3 quarters out from election day, presidential popularity at that same point in time, the length of time that the president's party's held the White House, and you can do pretty good predictive models in there. And you have another argument that says, well, that just basically sets the context for which an election takes place. And what really matters there are the decisions that candidates make in that within that framework there, and who's able to take better advantage of the macro environment and able to reach voters with a message that is consistent with the environment, but at the same time is able to demonstrate that they have the upper hand on it. So if we go back to, say, the 2000 election, this was an election everybody in the world thought Al Gore was probably going to win. Of course, he, in a very close race, turned out not to win it.
And he should have, based on the economic conditions.
Economic conditions, right? But then you go back, and I think I did this for a paper a long time ago.
And anyway, he did win.
He won the popular, absolutely. He didn't win the Electoral College. But at the end of the day, the question is, well, he didn't really stress the economy there, because that was sort of seen as he was trying to get out from beneath the Clinton shadow. And when he took one of his best cards off the table, that allowed some of the wedge issues to get in there, and George Bush to focus on his record, his education. So instead of just hammering the economy theme, he allowed the agenda to escape him, and he ended up losing a very close race through the Electoral College.
Mm-hmm. And then I had been covering politics for a decade. And is it just me or was it kind of a decade of strange elections? Because you had that one in 2000 in which the economy was great, but the president still lost. Then, of course, you had sort of the war president.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, if you look at that 2004 was an interesting election for a lot of reasons. The economy was still in fairly good shape at that amount of time, but voters weren't focusing on it. And what the Bush administration, the Bush campaign, I should say, did a very nice job about was making it about the choice. Right. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, and making it about a choice about national security. Right. And that was one of the few elections that you see among female voters where national security issues were a high priority. And Bush was able to win a much, much higher proportion of female voters than most Republicans do, largely on that issue. It very much reminded me of the 2010 Reid Engel race, right? Mm-hmm. That all the macro factors were working against Reid, but he basically said, let's make it a choice here. At the end of the day, do you want me in there? You may not like me, right? You may not like what I've done, but I'm a better option for Nevada. And that's very much the same thing that George Bush did. Mm-hmm. I'm a better option on terrorism, national security than John Kerry.
And 2006 is another odd case, because their national security, even though the economy was humming, of course the precipice was coming, but the economy was at least ostensibly okay. But it was a bad election for Republicans, the incumbent party.
And there you see the scandal very well kick in, if you mm-hmm. will. You had all those issues involving with some of the House Republicans there, the lobbyists there, Jack Abramoff, all that stuff coming to a head. And I think there was also at this point getting a little bit of fatigue that the Republican revolution had sort of lost its way. Bush, made the calculated, in hindsight, a big error to stake his electoral capital, if you will, on reforming Social Security without his party backing him. And so it all just sort of kind of drifted away after that. And obviously the handling of Iraq at that point had gotten to the point where, there was very little support within and outside of government.
Mm-hmm. And in 2008, felt like a transformative election, but maybe it was just the economy.
You certainly had economic factors in there. You had the same party in there for 8 years. in there. And, you know, there's always this notion, and we look at 06, 08, 010, is that the election is the electorate's reverbing back and forth between these ideological poles. Another way to interpret those election is that the people aren't really satisfied with anything they're getting out of government, and they're willing to go with the alternative here. You know, at the end of the day, the vast majority of voters are moderates who just want problems solved. They don't really care much about the ideological orientation of government or the ideological underpinnings of this policy versus that one. And a lot of times, because the politicians, they get in their bubbles, right? And in a primary, all you're talking to are the far left voters if you're a Democrat, and the far right voters if you're a Republican. That's where the money comes from. So those voices speak loudly, and the sort of folks in the middle, not quite so engaged, but they're not seeing a lot of satisfaction with the outcomes in government right now.
So let's talk about 2012. The macro conditions for the president are pretty terrible.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so if you're of that school of thought that that's what matters, the people's feeling of economic security and well-being is what's going to drive this election, then he looks like he's going
to
lose.
Absolutely. If you looked at, you know, we're not to the third quarter yet in the election before, but we look at that unemployment, I can't imagine it's going to change a lot. Gross domestic product's not going to tick up all that much. His popularity, he might be able to move it a little bit, but it's still going to be under 50%. By all of those indicators, yeah, we would predict by the sort of macro theory of elections that he would lose, and his party would probably lose seats in both the House and the Senate. The other school of thought would say that, well, yeah, certainly he's been dealt a bad hand, but you still see in the polls roughly about half the population still, or these polls respondents still look to the Republicans. They blame the Republicans aren't out of the woods yet, despite their attempts to reframe a lot of this there. So voters still remember that. At the end of the day, I think across the board, in Republicans would agree that you still have a pretty weak field of Republicans there. Mitt Romney's now been running for president for 6 years, and he hasn't been able to seal the deal with his party. Now they seem to be courting Chris Christie after the sort of Rick Perry didn't deliver there. The Michelle Bachmann fell flat a little bit after the Ames poll there. So in some respects, the best thing Obama has going for him is his competition.
Mm-hmm. And he has no choice but to make this a choice election.
Absolutely. I mean, it's going to be right out of Reid Angle all over again.
And it's going to be deeply negative.
Oh, absolutely. Certainly. Absolutely.
And how does that – how will this play out in Nevada, where if the president's macro conditions, the state of the economy is bad nationally, it's terrible here?
It is, and it was terrible 2 years ago when we saw a Democrat win statewide. I mean, mm-hmm. The status quo, you know, even though that was a sweeping election, you look across the board, okay, the Democrats lose one House seat by 2,000 votes, very close race. They pick up a total of 3 state legislative seats. So in a wave election, not really a big wave. And a lot of that goes down to the strength of the parties in the state. I mean, we talk about the Democratic operation that Reid's been able to create since 2004. The Republicans have been talking a lot about creating something similar, but at the same time, there's no figure of comparable status of Reid who's been willing to push around people in his own party to step on toes to get the outcome he wants there. And of course, they have the tension, you know, nationally, I think is a microcosm here between the Tea Party activist wing versus the establishment wing.
Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about the Republican caucus here. To begin with, there's been a lot of back and forth on when it's actually going to take place. So now I guess it'll be in January. Who will be the favorite, do you think, here?
I think it's still Romney's to lose. I mean, he's the known commodity here. He's the only one with any significant resources here. I think you have, you know, the Herman Cain folks are going to invest here. But at the end of the day, how much mileage is he going to get out of that? The problem for the Republicans is there's not a lot of delegates here. And so if they're going to be making strategic decisions, looking at the map, looking where the delegates are, looking at their probabilities, and everybody sort of thinks, well, Mitt Romney can do really, really well there. If we go there and compete and lose, that boosts him. If no one bothers to compete, it's a non-event. And there's a lot more delegates to be won in South Carolina and in Florida at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Although Nevada Republicans were helped by the governor's recent endorsement.
He was, but so far we haven't seen Perry come at the end of the day. Yeah, certainly there is that. But at the end of the day,
did you find that strange?
I found it strange for a couple of reasons. The first, the timing was weird, right during the special election. I didn't think there was a real need for him to do that. I don't think, you know, people obviously would want his endorsement, but I think he had more to gain by holding off. The other part of it was, is he did it before Perry was tested. And now at the end of the day, Perry looks a lot weaker now, just a couple of weeks after that. And does he now potentially alienate a significant part of the LDS population, which is a big part of the Republican Party here?
Mm-hmm. By moving away from Romney.
By moving away from Romney and endorsing Perry.
Right. So you're, and what about, we mentioned the Tea Party wing of the party. I mean, they could still play kind of a spoiler role with Ron Paul, of course.
One certainly Ron Paul, or, but the thing is, the question is are they unified behind a candidate? I mean, that I think is to be the interesting question, because you have, you know, Herman Cain's making a push for those voters. Michelle Bachmann obviously is at some level. I think Rick Perry resonates with a lot of those folks. And then the Ron Paul has the most devoted following, as we saw 4 years ago. Those people haven't gone anywhere. They overtook mm-hmm. the entire Republican convention.
Right.
And you know,
well, they went to Middle Earth for a couple of years.
But they came back. So, yeah, so you have all of those factors coming in here. But at the end of the day, a caucus is a very different thing than a primary. You know, you can run the mass media, but it's all about getting your people to the right spot at the right point in time. And for the average voter,
it happens on a specific time.
It happens on a specific day, and you have to go to a specific place yeah. at a specific point in time and be willing to sit there for an extended period of time. It's a much greater commitment than just voting in a primary. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, you know, the decision last week fighting over same-day registration versus not, in, you know, the activist base, they don't want same-day registration. And I think strategically they're correct in that sense, as they want to be able to control the process. They want to know who's going to be coming in the door. They want to be organized. And if you open the door to whoever walks in there, it can increase a whole lot of uncertainty.
Mm-hmm. Although for the party in the long run.
In the party, it's harmful. Absolutely. Yeah, in the party.
It's worked for Democrats extraordinarily well.
It worked
well
extremely well. Yeah. I mean, where they, on caucus day last in 08, you registered 30,000 folks.
Right.
You know, and that carried over, I think, to election day here. So you have to balance that. And that's the tension. I think the Republicans, they want to use that enthusiasm. But I think the establishment Republicans want to use it for their own purposes, that maybe it's somewhat at odds with what the Tea Party, you know, to the degree. I mean, they're not a unified Tea Party. I mean, you know, in the popular press is this unified bunch, but they're anything but unified.
Mm-hmm. Do you actually think that the Republicans will be ready to put a caucus on? It's kind of it's a pretty complicated event, and of course, to do it well,
mm-hmm.
you have to have quite a bit of money, organization, and then to make it meaningful, you'd have to have the candidates here. We haven't seen much of that.
Yeah, I think all those things hurt them. The first thing is, you know, yeah, they brought in talent. They brought in national talent here. How much money do they have to do this? Now they're putting it together here. The one thing that they did do was they changed their rules to make it actually a meaningful event. If we go back 4 years ago, it was essentially a non-binding straw poll, and the real business was selecting delegates to what would have been the county conventions and ultimately the state convention, and that's where the real decisions were made, whereas the Democrats, what happened at your local caucus was binding as you moved up through the process there. So the Republicans have changed their rule in that respect to make it much more important what happens in those caucus settings. But at the end of the day, it's a much, much more difficult organizational part of it here. You don't have a strong party organization from which to start. The clock's ticking, and you know, they're still fighting over basic things like when the day is it going to be? Are we going to allow same-day registration? Again, what candidates ultimately are going to invest here? It makes it all a very, very difficult set of problems, I think, for the Republican Party in this state.
Mm. Should be interesting to watch. You're listening to KUNV. This is Neon Eden. My guest today is Dave DeMore, political scientist at UNLV. Let's shift gears to the census. I know that you have done a lot of work on the Intermountain West and what the political map looks like now after the 2010 census.
Well, the two overwhelming factors in the Intermountain West is Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico, Nevada, Utah, and Idaho there, is you have essentially increased diversity, right? The non-white population across the region has dipped dramatically. Even a state like Utah.
Increased dramatically.
Yeah. Even a state like Utah, you have 19% is non-white now. Whereas a few years, you know, last time around, I think they were 86% white. So even in Utah and Idaho, you're starting to see some of the demographic shifts that have obviously happened here, Arizona, New Mexico, and Colorado. So that's the first major trend. The other mention is that we have some of the densest populations in the country here. We tend to think of the Mountain West as being this rural area. because historically that's what it was here. But you look at Clark County, I mean, that's 74%, 73% of all the folks in Nevada live in one county. You throw in Washoe, you're like 86, 87% of the population's in two counties. Same way in down in Arizona, about 63, 64% live in the Phoenix metro area. So you have incredibly dense populations in these huge rural spaces here. Even in a state like Idaho, I think it's 40% of all Idaho residents live in Boise. So we see that. And what makes that interesting is because traditionally in all of these legislatures, rural interest held sway. Certainly in Nevada, but across the region, you saw that here. In all of these states, all six of these states have very small legislative chambers. All of them are, I believe, the national average for a lower chamber is 110. The biggest is Utah's at 75. Only New Mexico is above the average for the state Senate, and they're at 42. The national average is 39. So why that's important is because you end up getting huge rural districts, and they're getting smaller and smaller, and they're getting fewer and fewer, and they're getting bigger and bigger because you're not going to make these legislatures any bigger in this sort of anti-government region here. So throw in term limits here, you're starting to see the rural influence wane, and it's obviously being replaced by minority legislators. We saw that certainly in Nevada in 2010, but even in Utah, you have five Latinos in the state legislature in Utah, which, you know, I found shocking when I was doing the work on this here. So what you end up having here is, yeah, we're not going to grow like we did this last decade, but it's still a fast-growing state, right? So that creates a lot more uncertainty. The other thing that goes on in this region is lots of nonpartisans. That's the fastest growing demographic here. I think Arizona's at 30%, Colorado's 26%, New Mexico and Nevada about 15% nonpartisans. So you have an electorate that's less tethered to the parties. You have pretty weak party institutions in all of these states here. You have this increasing diversity and this increasing density of population. So these states look very, very different from what they did 2 years ago. And so, you know, arguably you could say in the last 10 years, you have essentially three Republican-leaning states, Colorado, New Mexico, and Nevada are now essentially Democratic-leaning states in a short period of time. And all of the demographic projections favor the Democrats in this region here. So by decade's end, Arizona, I think, is going to join that group, if not sooner.
Mm-hmm. So is there anything that Republicans can do to reverse that?
Well, obviously, I think that they need to change their outreach message, right? I mean, let's take a look
at those Latino voters.
Absolutely, because they're not monolithic. Even in a state like Nevada, where Democrats have invested hundreds of thousands of dollars, they're still getting only 70% of the Latino, which is a lot, obviously, but it's not anywhere near what you'd see among African Americans, for instance, there. Mm-hmm. So that's a big part of it. But at the end of the part, they seem
to be... What's been wrong with the outreach message?
Well, there hasn't been any. Yeah. I mean, it's largely, to some degree, focused on social issues. You know, some of that, you know, using the Latino Catholic link as a way to sort of push social issues. But Latinos are much more, you know, interested in economic security and a lot of those same issues, opportunities for their children here. Clearly, some of the policies coming out of Arizona and Utah to a lesser degree have aided the Democrats in the region here. And yes, you do have in the region, you have two Latino governors who are Republicans, Susana Martinez in New Mexico, and obviously Brian Sandoval here, but that's about it. All the other elected officials who are of Latino or Hispanic origin all have D's next to their name. You look at the Nevada Republican caucus and legislature, the diversity begins and ends with two white women, and you're in a state now with 46% non-white population. So that symbolic stuff matters. I know you wrote critically about Reuben Kuhn the other day, but for that community, symbolic representation is very, very important. And when they look up and they don't see much beyond white faces on the Republican side of the ledger, you talk about these policies in these other states here, it makes the job much, much more difficult to increasingly rely on an older white rural base.
Mm-hmm. And then I would suspect that their other problem is they don't really have much of an urban policy cupboard.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that that's a big part. Not that the Democrats have a great one at the end of the day. But much of their what you have in these states, I think Nevada's the case study of this, is just essentially trying to preserve a status quo that benefits the traditional bases of those supports in terms of tax policy, in terms of how money gets actually cut up by the state legislature. So, you know, are they going to come in and talk about urban renewal and some of those arguments that haven't been traditionally there? Voters in the urban area, they tend to be more concerned about environmental issues and about sustainability issues. Those aren't exactly Republican strengths in Nevada or elsewhere.
Let's move on to a kind of related subject, and that is you were speaking of the declining influence of rural legislators throughout the whole Intermountain West as the urban areas have grown much faster than the rural areas. Let's talk about that in Nevada. I think you have you're beginning to work on a book on the subject.
I mean, essentially what you have in this region is traditionally you had malapportionment, that essentially districts for state legislatures were drawn not based upon population, but based upon geography. And that tended to over represent rural interests and under represent urban interests. Now, yeah, that went away in the mid-60s, but there's a couple of things that happened.
By one man, one vote.
By the one person, one vote, absolutely. First at the U.S. Congress, then at the state legislature, and then you had to have a whole bunch of other cases to deal with the local regents and that kind of stuff there. But that doesn't get rid of seniority, right? Because you know, term limits only kicked in here a few years ago, right? So even though you said, okay, we're going to create these new districts, the most senior rural legislators were still there. The other part of it is they were calling the shots when a good deal of the state institutions were created. Mm-hmm. Right? So institution,
like higher education.
Higher education's case in point, this was not originally created as a standalone institution. It was the southern branch of the University of Nevada, Reno. And it didn't get its own status until 1968, somewhere around 2 years after malapportionment was ended here. Mm-hmm. But even with that, we've never been funded at the same level as UNR because they created the institutions, they created the structure, they created the funding. And, you know, at the end of the day, we send a divided partisan southern delegation up to Carson City. They're only there for 4 years. They don't have time to get caught up on the issues there. They're going to vote party line because that's the simplest way for them to vote, right? And at the end of the day, they're not looking at funding formulas. Tell me how many legislators could explain to you the higher ed or the K-12 funding formula, but that's in the details. And I mean, you hate to point your finger at one guy, but when one guy ran that legislature for 38 years, mm-hmm. and I'm talking about Bill Raggio, of course, is that, you know, that all that stuff gets entrenched in the institutions itself. And that's the part that's much more difficult to explain and much, much more difficult to ultimately dismantle. So we still see at the end of the day that we're, you know, in this biennium, about $1 billion in tax revenue that's generated in Southern Nevada is going to go pay for government services elsewhere in the state there. How are we ever supposed to develop with that kind of, with those kinds of policies?
Have term limits, what is the effect of term limits on that disparity?
Term limits is a little bit of a mixed bag. On the plus side, you get rid of some of the old rivalries and some of the old pettiness, and you know, I don't think it's any coincidence that in a term limit legislature, mining holds less sway. All these people who, you know, coming in here and saying, well, why is this the way it operates, for instance, there. So you get that, but the downside you get is obviously you get amateur legislators, right? And particularly in a state where we have low legislative professionalism, they don't have a lot of capacity, they don't have a lot of resources, they're not in session a lot. It exacerbates that. It plays to the governor's hand. The other part of the research we find is that in term limited legislatures, that the members are less cognizant or less representative of their local interests, that they're much more concerned about positioning themselves for their next office, expanding their appeal to a broader swath of voters than sort of, if you were there, you knew you had to represent these voters for 30 years in order to become the Speaker of the House. That's a very different calculus there. So at the end of the day, you end up with less professionalism, which I think helps the governor. Right, and there's no surprise that Governor Sandoval vetoes every attempt by the legislature to lengthen their leash. There, you end up with people looking for jobs there, and I think governing and policymaking, you lose that expertise, you lose that knowledge. And at the end of the day, you know, we have term limits. They're called regularly scheduled elections. And they work pretty well at getting the worst of the worst. There's other reforms you can take into place that can lead to more competitive elections than just simply saying after X amount of time, you can't do this job anymore.
They won't ever be overturned.
It's interesting. The only two states that's overturned them are Idaho and Utah. The voters imposed them, and the Republicans who dominate those legislatures, they ended up, through the legislative process, getting rid of them once over a veto of a governor, I believe in Utah there. So the irony is in the reddest of the red states in the region, you have the politicians got rid of the term limits. And that was one of the interesting things when I was working on the reapportionment and redistricting in the region on that book chapter there is, I knew there was politics in those states, but I wasn't quite sure where it would be. And that's what you find. It's about the space. So if you look at the Utah redistricting, they are going to carve up that state into all these little spots here. They're going to carve out these little safe districts for these incumbents because they know that they have to hold that seat for, you know, another decade to get a committee chairmanship there. And they're less concerned about the community of interest in keeping them whole and more worried about their security. In Idaho, we talked about a moment ago about, you know, the waning influence of rural legislatures. Well, they knew it was on the writing on the wall. So what did they do? They passed a law in 2009 in Idaho that would essentially only way you could combine rural counties was if they were all served by the same highway. That's how you had to create a district. So essentially what they ended, it's very, very clever, right? So you end up essentially creating these sort of rural districts, you know, and it's a big mess there. And in one state, you figure they built one party state, you think they would be able to figure it out there. But to sort of protect the traditional rural interest there, they've really constrained the way those maps can be drawn to sort of limit the influence of the urbanization of Idaho.
In other states, is it the same thing where the urban legislators are divided and...
Well, it's a little different across the region because three of the states commissions draw them, right? So Arizona, you have a commission.
No, I mean as far as resources go. So,
I see what you're saying. I think we're the worst because you have such a, you know, the industries, there's two industries in the state. Right, one's northern, one's southern. I was talking to a guy who was in politics in Arizona. He says it's different in Arizona because you don't have these huge industries where they become the target there. The taxes are much broader based there. At least you know politicians try to play favorites, but you just can't say go tax gaming. You can't go say tax mining because there's nothing equivalent of that like it is here. So I think, yeah, you certainly have that. And that's one of the things we would like to look at down the road is, you know, is Nevada atypical or more typical of what we see in these other states there? But I think the tax bases are just so different from what we have here, and they're much more stable, of course, the discrepancies aren't quite as large. But traditionally, I mean, you know, state governments have always tilted towards rural interests.
Mm-hmm. Will, real quickly, we only have a minute left, but will these population changes you talked about earlier, will that have impact on the disparity between North and South?
Well, you would think so. I mean, this time around, I mean, you're going to see fewer standalone districts at the end of the day, rural districts here. I think you're going to end up with
And
at the end of the day, you're going to have 48 of 63 either all or part in Clark County. So the degree that we can sort of make this not about party and more about region, that you should be able to hit some of those differences. And obviously, if they're able to keep pushing on the mining constitutional amendment, that changes things dramatically in, 2016.
Thanks, Dave DeMore, political scientist at UNLV. You've been listening to KUNV. Our engineer, Stephen Zeller. I'm J. Patrick Kulikin. Have a good day.